surprised to see me here?
I knew you'd come.
Morton once told me I could never be like him. Now I understand why. Wouldn't have bothered him knowing you were around somewhere alive.
So you found out you're not a businessman after all?
Just a man.
An ancient race. Other mortals will be along, and they'll kill it off.
Future don't matter to us. Nothing matters now, not the land, not the money, not the woman. I came here to see you. Because I know that now you'll tell me what you're after.
One of the greatest westerns ever made, Once Upon a Time in the West. And if you haven't seen that, you haven't seen a western. And this is Terrible Tommy, and it's October the 6th, 2017, and it's Freya's Day, Ladies' Day in the bunker. We salute all the lady lone wolves, yeah. Don't forget, don't send any more mail to that State Street address. Only to this one. That's P.O. Box 1687, San Jacinto, California, 92583. That's the only place to send your mail now, and it's time to get your donations in. Yeah. You know, I heard a rumor that Kid Rock was having a concert up in Detroit, whether it's coming up or whether it's happened. I'm not sure, but said that some local biker clubs came down to stand between his fans and the picketing, rioting neo-Bolsheviks. I'm not sure whether that's going to happen in the future or whether it's already happened, but if it has happened, that's great. I've always had a certain affinity for the bikers. Well, I've rode some bikes, not big bikes, but sort of ha-ha bikes, even rice burners. I never will forget the time we had a rally out in Oklahoma, a music concert for the skinheads. And in Oklahoma, you can own and fire a machine gun. And so the host of the group's meeting had a machine gun. And guess what? They took a rice burner motorcycle, put it out in the middle of the field, and everybody got to go at it with a machine gun. It's the only time in my life I ever fired a machine gun. But we did fire, I was around when it was fired later on that night when we were attacked by some Indians, so-called Indians, Mongols. And some white boys that come out there on a pickup truck and decide they're going to take us on. They come around the property shooting everything, trying to shoot stuff, and pellets were landing on the house and everything. And I yelled at the host. I said, "Hey, they're shooting at us." And he said, "Direct my fire." I was right underneath his barrel of his gun. And I said, "Right out there they are in that pickup truck." And he let go of that machine gun and just ripped the whole side out of that pickup truck. And it's a wonder nobody was killed. The next day the sheriff said, because the sheriff was fairly friendly, or at least fair, they took that truck and exhibited it downtown, the little town that was close by. And people coming from all around to see that truck, because that whole side of the truck was full of bullet holes, but yet nobody was hurt. Nobody was killed. Nobody was shot. So that was a good thing. That was a good thing. This shows you don't screw with the white boys unless you've got 100 cops around to protect the other people. Because in a true street battle, the white boys are going to win. And they can be outnumbered 10 to 1, too. And if they can't win, being outnumbered 10 to 1, they better get out of the way and go back to mama. I've been digging out some old pictures of like that Oceanside riot and so forth, out of old papers I've kept, and I've got to do something about it before they fall totally to pieces. So we're going to be clipping out these good pictures and scanning them and making them available on the website. I should have done it a long time ago, because some of these pictures are starting to yellow, but scanners will straighten that out. So we'll have some good riot photos for you as time goes on. A lot of these pictures I forgot I even had, especially after moving across the country a couple of times with all my goodies. You know, I was looking around yesterday, came across this edict of the expulsion in 1290 when the king kicked the Jews out of England. A lot of right-wingers and so forth go on and on about this and what a great thing it was. And it was in a sense, but the problem you have, and I've had this argument with the conservative right for a long time, that Jews only really prosper when Aryans are corrupt. And if the Aryans aren't corrupt, the Jews don't have much power, because they deal in money lending and all the vices that many in leadership of the racial Aryan nations go along with, like most of the kings. People give the Jews hell for loaning money to the king to wage war. Well, the point is, why would he want to wage war except for the defense of his country, which happened once in a while? But these Aryan kings back then were borrowing money all the time for all kinds of bullshit, like the Crusades. The Crusades was the biggest bunch of nonsense, one of the big bunches of nonsense ever to happen. It was going down there to look for somebody that didn't exist. Or even if he did exist, it was a tremendous waste of money. King of England went broke financing Crusades. Then they had the Children's Crusade and all that. So anyhow, I can go back and find all over the place where it's been a Christian, so-called Christian versus Jew, but the Christians in many cases were involved on a bigger scale with corruption, and the Jews just do what they do. They want to get their piece of the pie off the table, the crumbs off the table, and they're able to build that into big fortunes, but it's based upon Aryan corruption. If you don't want Jews in power, then it's simple. Get rid of Aryan corruption, like we have in the Hollywood and all that kind of stuff, and the liquor business. All that stuff is controlled by the Jews. But do you ever see anybody really trying to get rid of it? Well, no, because there's too much profit for the non-Jews. So I like to be as honest as possible when we're talking about history. And that's one of the things that galls my ass, and you don't hear it on the right hardly at all. You don't hear it definitely not among the religious right, because to them, they're all wonderful, and they got the appointment and approval of Jesus Christ, God Almighty in heaven, you know, which is all bullshit. But remember that. Yeah. If you start seeing the rise of power of the Jews in any country, it's because the corrupt people of the country have left the gates open to the Jews or anybody else. They've left the gates open for the Muslims before, and they're doing it again, you know. So we got a hell of a job to clean up the white race. And as far as I'm concerned, the amount of corruption among the white upper classes and the laziness of the lower classes. Needs to be a lot of kicking ass going on among our own race. And if we never clean that up, you're never going to clean the whole picture up. You're not going to do it, because these people get greedy. They want all the oil, they want all the gold, they want all the silver, they want everything. And they go to the Jews and borrow money or credit from the Jews. And then when things go wrong, they cry and moan. Like all those kings that went broke financing bullshit programs of warring on their neighbor. So I think as an Aryan lone wolf, I have to be in that position to sound the alarm on that, because hardly anybody does, because they say, oh, my side's wonderful. My Christian side was wonderful. Or my king was great. He was wonderful. Just like they do today. My president, he's okay. All kinds of corruption going on, and he could do something about it, but he's not doing it, so yeah, but he's okay because he's a Christian, or he's this, or he's that. Wanted to pass that along to you. If you want to find out how much corruption is in the country, start counting the number of important, powerful Jews in your census. And now it's gotten so bad at this late date that actually the Jews themselves are internally full of corruption and don't help their people, you know, or like I said years ago, 250,000 Jews living in New York City were living below the poverty line, and it's gotten a lot worse, I'm sure. So the very corruption that they've spread everywhere else is now big time among themselves, to where the leaders of Israel are all going to be up on charges, and Bibi's going to court, his wife is going to court, the gardener's going to court, everybody. So everybody's joining the corruption party. It's no longer the liberal or conservative party or Republican or Democrat, it's the corruption party. There's only one party. Well, me and my main squeeze took advantage of Senior Citizen Day at the theater. It's the only day I can afford to go to the movies, and saw the second version of Blade Runner. I love the first version of Blade Runner. It's a thinking person's film. The second one I liked almost as well, maybe more from a different angle, Blade Runner. It's a thinking person's type of movie. And I'm concerned, be interesting how much money it makes, because it's not this bullshit Amitatron and all these giant monsters and all that kind of crap, Godzilla, mechanical warfare and all that. I can't hardly sit through the previews of that bullshit. And then they wonder why kids get violent, why people get violent. That's all they're getting is violence. I like a good detective story, you know. I like a simple story, not a lot of fanfare, not a lot of music and so forth. Just a story, a mystery. Who done it? That's what I like. But Blade Runner, the music was great too on this version of Blade Runner. I can't fault the actors. So anyhow, that's my take on Blade Runner too. And there's a lot of what I would call hidden messages in that film. In fact, a hell of a lot of the films, I know we damn Hollywood all the time, but there's writers in Hollywood that have messages in their films that the first layer of the population just will not get or don't understand, that sink into the thinking of a lot of other people. And not all. And they're not all liberal left-wing Bolsheviks. So if you don't notice that and don't understand that, better start dissecting some of these films more closely. Look at them more closely and look underneath what the story is and the story running along parallel to it. And I hope some people out there understand that. any film, there can be two or three, four more messages than you want, than you need. And many of them are on our side. Yeah, I know you don't believe that. You think it's all a bunch of kikes putting out the movies. And there may be, but there are guys that are writing for these films that are lowballing information into the film that's great. In fact, most of the time, the best way to do it is the bad guy is your hero. Nobody can keep you from doing that. You can switch the parts around all you want. I mean, and I find myself in the films being for the bad guy rather than the good guy. In many cases, not all cases. Yeah. Just like in life, you've got to be selective and discriminate. And there's a lot of good stuff in some films. There's a lot of good stuff in some TV shows and things like that. But you got to discriminate yourself and choose between the rotten ones and the good ones, or the ones with a little bit of good and the ones with a lot of bad and all that kind of stuff. Take it from Tommy. Because you don't have to accept the way they deliver you a film. They can send you a race-mixing film, but you can turn it around in your mind, because your mind is able to do that and make the bad guys good guys and the good guys bad guys. And don't pay any attention to a lot of the verbiage, because so what, you know? Well, I got a little note here from Bill White. I never had too much to do with Bill White when he was running this Nazi party down in North Carolina and renting out cheap houses to Negroes and stuff, and he got in trouble. But however, since most of the anti-Bill White came from the newspapers, you can't believe anything. He says, "Thank you for your letter of July 17, 2017. Honestly, don't even know what the right wing is to me. It's all Judah. Just different faces." Well, that's correct, except for the white corruption, the Aryan corruption. If you haven't seen my latest AFD ad, I'm enclosing it. Yeah, I did. It's pretty good information. Unfortunately, I don't choose what the government releases. Since my arrest, they've been withholding documents, lying to the courts, and doing everything in their power to make sure I can't prove that they frame me. Slowly, though, they are cracking. I will send you anything else I get which interests you. I have an FOIA lawsuit here in the Southern Illinois, I think that is, which is finally moving forwards, and they have until the end of the month to explain why it takes 4 years to assure a FOIA request. Thank you for the article. I agree that American study is a dead end. America is a dead end, dying dead end. Yeah. Yeah, that's William White. He's 13888-084. He's at Marion, so if you want to talk to him, you can reach him there. At the time he was taking all these people on, I thought he was pretty much putting his head in the lion's mouth at the time, but I didn't know enough about the situation to really comment that much. Incidentally, Dennis Mahon is in the SHU and on the road, and he may be at a new location by now, probably is, and I'll have to check the Federal Register and find out where he's at. So if you're writing Dennis Mahon, you might want to hold up until you get his new address.
This is Walter Dennis. I'd like to ask you something. What would America's founding fathers have done if they knew that someday a black man would be president of the United States? Our first president, George Washington, and many of his compatriots owned thousands of Negro slaves. Others, such as Thomas Jefferson, tried deporting America's black population to a West African state still known as Liberia. He wrote into the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, that a Negro shall be considered only 3/5 of a person, a non-citizen, unable to vote. Today, if you travel to our nation's capital, you'll read the following words inscribed in stone on the Jefferson Memorial. Quote, "Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people, the Negroes, are to be free." Unquote. Thomas Jefferson's statement is allowed to end there, leaving visitors with the impression that our third president was a liberal integrationist. But this quotation from his autobiography has been taken out of its original context. Someone has selectively deleted the rest of Jefferson's words, which are, quote, "Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion have drawn indelible lines of distinction between them." Unquote. But what about Abraham Lincoln? He freed the slaves, so he must have loved them. Liberals like to imagine that by calling upon his memory, they lend authority to their racially integrated agendas. But this is what Lincoln said during his fourth presidential debate on September 18, 1858. Quote, "I will say then that I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people. And I will say, in addition to this, that there is a physical difference between the black and white races which will ever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. And inasmuch as they cannot so live, while they do remain together, there must be the position of superior and inferior. And I, as much as any other man, am in favor of having the superior position assigned to the white race." Unquote. Today, any politician running for public office, in fact, anyone making such a statement, would be loudly condemned as a racist of the worst possible kind, expelled from school or fired from his job, and arrested on charges of committing a hate crime. Yet Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington are supposed to be our country's great icons. No teacher, no one in the news or entertainment media will ever tell you what these men actually believed about so-called Afro-Americans. Nor will they tell you that blacks are responsible for more than 80% of violent crimes committed in our country, even though Negroes make up just 12% of its population. That must come as a shock to regular viewers of television, where blacks are around half the faces seen on the tube. Unlike their real-life versions, televised blacks are almost invariably portrayed as pitiful victims of injustice at the hands of white bigots, or lovable heroes deserving our adoration and emulation. This is because television is nothing more than a backed-up toilet overflowing with lies. It is a font of poison floating with stinking falsehoods in which truth dies and sinks. Beginning after the turn of the last century, race-mixing propagandists have taken particular delight in elevating half-breeds to superstar status. Television personalities and political celebrities of black and white parentage are more often placed upon the highest public pedestals for special homage. At the same time, no opportunity is missed to promote racially mixed unions, typically of a blonde white woman to a blue-black male, together with the couple's half-breed offspring, which invariably take after their African father. When we look around the world at racially mixed countries, we find such exotic lands as India, Morocco, and Mexico. These places are human garbage dumps, characterized by squalor, violence, starvation, filth, and disease on a colossal scale of hopeless misery. They were not always so. 4,000 years ago, a civilization of clean-swept boulevards and magnificent public baths flourished throughout the Indus Valley. 2,000 years later, Morocco was set with marble temples and gleaming health spas, a jewel in the crown of the Roman Empire. 500 years ago, conquistadors from Spain raised a prosperous colony upon the ruins of Aztec-Indian human sacrifice and cannibalism. All of these formerly high cultures in Mexico, Morocco, and India were created exclusively by white civilizers. While colored natives may have supplied some of the labor, civilization was the product of white genius. So long as the white master builders preserved their dominance and racial integrity, society functioned as intended. But as they interbred with Negroes and other lowlife, white identity drowned in a raceless morass of darkening generations that bore less and less resemblance to their fair-skinned founding fathers. Their originally high intelligence level sank into an increasingly dumber and savage population. The once splendid civilizations of the Indus Valley, Central America, and North Africa decayed into the rotting urban centers now known as New Delhi, Tijuana, or Marrakesh. America stands in the same shadow that eventually reduced these formerly civilized centers to subhuman cesspools. Such putrid places graphically represent the goal set for our country by fanatic integrationists who embrace race mixing with all the fervor of religious extremists. Their aim is to reduce the United States to another Bangladesh or Sudan. The mass murderers of our posterity flaunt their sympathy for the colored downtrodden of this world in order to parade what they imagine is a kind of moral superiority over everyone else. These people are truly insane. Their real core motivation is a psychopathic loathing for everything and everyone white. That only can explain such hysterical intolerance of the slightest criticism for the race-mixed utopia they demand. They cannot work fast enough for the eventual extirpation of the white race through wholesale interbreeding with Congoid apes. Their aim is the dissolution of all the world's races into a single global souffle of genetic excrement. And anyone who raises an objection to their high-minded nightmare is condemned and ostracized as a racist, an enemy to what is ever fair and good. Yet, what we take for granted today as civilization is the exclusive product of white men and women. From computers and hair curlers to bicycles and space shuttles, everything we know as modern technology was brought about entirely by white inventors. It stands to reason that when their kind no longer exists, their creations will disintegrate, just like old American cars falling apart in the littered streets of Mexico City. While white people were building great civilizations around the world for the last 5,000 years, blacks in Africa never figured out how to make a wheel. They never built anything more substantial than a mud hut. They knew nothing about metal, glass, or tool. They never had a written language. Their technology did not extend beyond the tip of their wood spears. Their only medicine was voodoo. They never sailed on anything greater than a floating log, even though they resided along thousands of miles of coastline. And all this centuries before they could claim slavery as an excuse for their utter lack of know-how. They never put one stone upon another, thought of a light bulb, invented an airplane, designed a fountain pen, wrote a poem, painted a portrait, or initiated anything associated with civilized life. Although Afro-Americans have come to benefit from these things and more, they created none of them. They have always excelled, however, in those activities which characterize them best, violent behavior and monumental squalor. For proof, drive through the south side of Chicago, into Gary, Indiana, or black streets in any metropolitan area, if you dare. There you will see old, rotting buildings tottering above gang-infested sinkholes of urban filth. These are the ruins of white civilization, microcosms for what the rest of America is becoming. This national decay translates itself into escalating murders, assaults, rapes, robberies, and a virtual tidal wave of atrocities committed daily against white men, women, and children. Considered more important than their own self-defense, they are cautioned against racism when identifying their dark assailants. Because followers of the race-mixing dogma are indifferent to these white victims, outsiders rarely learn of their fate. They are not showcased on television, nor featured on the front page of a major newspaper. For example, a few years ago, charges were leveled against Duke University students accused of gang-raping an innocent black girl. months before the high-profile case collapsed because their ultra-liberal prosecutor was disbarred for falsifying the evidence against them, and the accuser herself turned out to be a lying half-wit, they were tried and found guilty by every major American newspaper and television network. The young white men were simultaneously and universally castigated as racists of the most awful type, meriting the severest punishment. Reverends Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson made daily telecasts deploring the climate of intolerance and sick racism that pervades our country. FBI spokesmen speculated that the alleged gang rape was a hate crime. Social services liberals swung into action to provide counseling and financial assistance for the bogus black victim and her family. While the falsely accused white students were being vilified across the nation week after week, Americans were pointedly not informed of another, this time authentic atrocity that was absolutely boycotted, deliberately ignored, hushed up, even censored from public knowledge. In a successful effort to contain all outside awareness of the story, no network anchorman or mainstream reporter announced the arrest in Kentucky of four black men and one black female for perpetrating some of the most ghastly crimes ever committed in U.S. history. They were accused of abducting and murdering a young white couple. While his girlfriend looked on, they castrated Christopher Newsom, 24, then burned him alive and fired several shots into him. Over the next several days, the satanic savages beat and raped his girlfriend, Shannon Christian, 23, and took turns urinating on her. On the fourth day, they cut off her breasts, stuffed a large variety of toxic chemicals, including floor cleaner, into her mouth, then slowly stabbed her to death. Not a word about this unspeakable crime was heard on the nightly news, because NBC, CBS, CNN, ABC, Fox, and all the rest of the alphabetical deceivers were obsessed at the time with the phony Duke University rape case. There was no appeal to the sensitivities of millions of regular viewers. No social services liberals thought to comfort the families of the white victims. The torture and murder of two young white people by five blacks is not a hate crime in the FBI's book. And Reverends Sharpton and Jackson had nothing to say. Their silence is part of the deliberate censorship of any information harmful to the artificial, false image of blacks perpetrated by America's news media masters. They realize that such censorship of the truth is vital to their race-mixing agenda. Yet we are invited to embrace these killer gorillas as our equals, no, as our physical, moral, and intellectual superiors. What then can we expect for the future? Unchecked, the forces of decline will climax in mid-century. Given the continuous and accelerating inundation of the United States by waves of immigrants from south of the border, Africa, Asia, India, and the Middle East, our continent's white population will have slipped to minority status before 2050. By then, our race will have become so polluted through interbreeding with subhumans, its identity will be progressively marginalized until it no longer exists. The next 40 years will also witness America's inevitable economic conquest by Red China and India, the very countries past U.S. presidents were so anxious to assist. Our standard of living will plummet to levels comparable with Ecuador or Somalia. Companies and businesses here will be largely Asian-owned, and Americans will have to work for mostly colored bosses. The U.S. dollar will eventually become so weak it must be replaced by some international currency. With health care largely in the hands of physicians from Pakistan or the Philippines, medical help will be rendered virtually useless, and certainly unable to keep pace with too many viral strains introduced by the endless deluge of germ-carrying colored immigrants. As in any fundamental social dislocation, a tsunami of criminal bloodshed will sweep across North America. Since white people by then will have been disarmed by gun control fanatics, their spirit of resistance diluted by decades of instilled health self-hatred, and all police forces predominantly black and brown, pale-faced victims can expect little protection and less mercy. They will suffer the same kind of massacres carried out in the past against hapless whites by Indian savages on the American plains. By then, the Bill of Rights promised that, quote, the right of the people to bear arms, unquote, will have been wiped away by the enemies of white America. One of its most prominent founders, Thomas Jefferson, insisted that, quote, no free man shall ever be debarred the use of arms against tyranny in government. The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants, unquote. In the years to come, only ruins and garbage will be left to show that the world was once inhabited by temporarily civilized but ultimately self-destructive human beings. Sounds like a rather bleak scenario for the future. That certainly is what the evangelists of race mixing want us to believe. Things have gone too far for some white Americans. They have given up without a fight, resigned themselves and their posterity to defeat and oblivion. They point out the shameful fact that a black man, worse, a mongrel half-breed, is now president of the United States. It was not the combined support of Negroes and Hispanics that won the election for him. Their endorsement could have been expected. No, he was voluntarily installed in the White House by a solid majority of white voters, the same people being exterminated by the very elements he himself personally embodies. More than 65 years ago, Adolf Hitler warned U.S. servicemen during World War II that their taking up arms against his racially aware country would inevitably backfire on them by putting a Negro in the White House. They laughed at him. The vast majority of white Americans in the 1940s regarded blacks then as little more than subhuman clowns, hardly worthy of attention. The very notion of a black-faced president had more in common with a comedy skit than anything in the foreseeable future. Yet, some of those Second World War veterans who once thought Hitler's prediction so amusing are no longer laughing. A colored chief executive was unthinkable, ludicrous even, until the early 1970s, when big city mayoral positions and state governorships were first occupied by Negroes. If a black mayor, some argued, why not a black president someday? Coincidental with the blacks advancing political power, all mainstream avenues of public information joined at every level of education to wring the last ounce of racial self-respect from our people. They were psychologically conditioned to embrace every manifestation of racial suicide in a comprehensive campaign as ubiquitous as it was relentless. A two-prong attack morally undercut white Americans by stressing their original sin of racism while constantly heroizing blacks as altogether superior, lovable creatures. Only decades of unrelieved and concerted propaganda made a Negro president possible. Without this incessant programming, such an incomparable disgrace would never have come to pass. Blacks are self-evidently too dim-witted to have achieved anything on their own. They represent merely a means to an end, namely the lethal pollution of our race. Once a white people have been poisoned by interbreeding, they disappear forever from the face of the earth, never to return. The original white builders of Egypt, Iran, Persia, India, and all the other lands that so long ago flourished, utterly vanished. Their formerly vibrant cultures reduced to dead ruins when they renounced the irreplaceable heritage of their pure blood. Racially weakened, their societies were beset by uncontrollable criminal violence, moral rot, economic collapse, political corruption, and cultural decay, until foreigners obliterated them. As the historian Will Durant warned us during the last century, quote, a great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself from within. Unquote. America is not exempt from that iron law, with Red China poised to take over from the United States as the next superpower. Accordingly, the U.S. seems doomed to repeat the same kind of suicide committed by past civilizations, and nothing can be done to stop it, so long as the majority of Americans are either indifferent to their country's fate or actually aiding and abetting it. So, What are you going to do? Let it go? Will you allow yourself to be pushed into the background and told to shut up, afraid to raise your voice in a feeble word of protest? Isn't there anything you can do that really matters? There is, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with complaining to your congressman, signing petitions, or writing to a newspaper editor. Your enemies brush aside such obsolete methods with a contemptuous laugh. The very first thing you have got to do is get mad. No one can do anything really meaningful unless they're consumed with justifiable anger. God knows you have more to be enraged about than you can even imagine. But you know enough about white kids beaten by Afro-American gangsters. You know enough about white women raped and tortured by black monsters. You know enough about the anti-white lies you're supposed to swallow in silence. You've got to get up and shout in the face of your enemy, "I'm a white American, damn it, and I'm not going to take your race-mixing crap anymore!" The psychotic Negrophiles are quick to denounce and label anyone who fails to embrace their savage yahoos as haters. But if you cannot hate someone who threatens your own loved ones with suffering and death, you're a failure as a human being. Anyone who won't defend those they love for fear of giving offense is a worthless coward. We can and will no longer be silenced by the race-mixing bullies pushing our world towards extinction. We will no longer be made ashamed of being white while others insist on black pride. We will not allow ourselves to be weakened by all those numerous, relatively petty differences that divide white men and keep us from forming a united front against the haters of our betrayed people. Those differences, how otherwise significant they may seem, must be put aside and not allowed to deflect one degree from our unity as white men and women. We must draw our wagons into a circle, close up our ranks in an unbreakable flank. Political, religious, class, ideological, or any of the other sorts of differences that threaten to divide our racial solidarity must be avoided. All that counts now is our self-awareness as white men and women. And anyone who attempts to detract one ounce from our racial unity has joined the enemies of white America. That the majority hates us or simply doesn't care about the survival of white America means nothing. When George Washington and his fellow revolutionaries took on the British Empire, the most powerful machine of its kind on earth, they were opposed by a solid majority of their own countrymen. Most people couldn't have cared less one way or the other. More than a third of Americans hated the Patriots, who were supported by just 15% of the colonial population. And from that small minority, only a fractional percentage actually participated in the war for independence. Yet, these few activists, against the will of a pro-British majority, themselves embodied a majority of willpower and energy to expel powerful invaders from our country. The American patriots who achieved this miracle were not liberals. They did not love their enemies. They were proud to be robust haters of the foreigners who imposed a frightful tyranny on the United States. The same situation confronts us today. Most white Americans are indifferent to the present decline and future destruction of their own race. To them, the only things that matter are making money and wasting their lives watching television. A majority of our fellow countrymen and women have been reduced to brainwashed lemmings, but not all of them. National election results for the past few years, where race-conscious candidates have run for office, have conclusively shown that 15% of our people understand and loathe the anti-white haters who have pushed us to the brink of extinction. That doesn't sound like much, but 15% of the U.S. population fleshes out into 37 million race-conscious white Americans. Within those 37 millions lies a 3% minority of 75,000 potential activists, a veritable army of warriors. The chief task of the anti-white establishment has always been to drive a wedge between the 37 million white people who have not yet lost their souls to race mixing and the 75,000 fighters who can lead them to victory over the corruptors of our racial integrity. Anyone who can appreciate the high significance of these percentages understands at once that he or she is not an isolated individual, a freak for refusing to embrace the race-mixed propaganda of our times, unlike most everyone else. On the contrary, there are millions and millions of white Americans just as inwardly disgusted and repelled by the colored pollution of our people as we are ourselves. These numbers may encourage us, but our resistance must not depend on them. If the spirits of America's proudly racist founding fathers could return to see how we, their descendants, have allowed the liberty they fought and died for to have been stolen by repulsive fugitives from the African jungle, they would command us as Patrick Henry did. "We must fight," he said. Listen to these words he spoke more than 200 years ago. Quote, "I repeat it, sir, we must fight. An appeal to arms and the God of hosts is all that is left to us. Should I keep back my opinions at such a time through fear of giving offense, I should consider myself as guilty of treason toward my country. Why stand we here idle? What is it that the gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." Unquote. That is the real American spirit that defied all the powers of hell and stood up to the hostile majority and won. It is a spirit no longer seen in our fellow countrymen because they have been lulled to sleep by the criminal conspirators against our lives, our liberty, and our posterity. How many more of our friends and family have to be mugged by black or Hispanic cowardly punks before you're mad enough to fight? How many more white kids are you going to allow to be beaten by colored gangbangers? How many more formerly white women must mate with darksome subhumans and bear their degraded offspring before our race is bred out of existence? For God's sake, man, get some guts! If you think things are bad now, just wait until 2040, when white people slip to minority status in the U.S. We've already become a minority in the American Southwest, and in major cities such as Chicago, where the white residents have been reduced to just one quarter of the total population, with a resultant spike in violent crime across the Windy City. Today, white people are already outnumbered by 8-to-1 odds on Earth. The American countdown has begun. Every 29 seconds, another illegal alien penetrates the United States. Every 10 minutes, another poisonous half-breed is spawned inside our borders. These hard facts embody the harsh truth about the real condition of our country. Get this through your head. America is threatened with death. Our struggle is for nothing less than our survival. Nothing in our lives is more important. No sacrifice we can make on its behalf too great. This struggle also ennobles us, however. It provides anyone who personally champions its cause the highest self-respect, because it embodies the brightest truth in this age of lies. The truth, hidden or knocked to the ground, always rises again to reveal itself. But it is not enough to see through the anti-white bias of our day. In itself, the most magnificent sword is no more than an inanimate object until someone has the courage to grasp it firmly by the handle and wield it against his enemies. So, too, a hidden truth is worthless until it is unsheathed and used to boldly cut down all liars. Patrick Henry and his fellow patriots knew the hard truth of their times and were brave enough to raise it in defense of liberty. They were not black or Latino or Jewish or octoroon, such as that racial anomaly in the White House. His installation is only a benchmark in the death of the United States. More significantly, however, it is a national wake-up call that remaining 15% of white Americans yet aware of their own racial identity can hear and understand. It means that the hour for their survival is very late. The alarm is blaring with terrible urgency. Let that same signal also reignite the revolutionary spark of our white forefathers. Let it catch your own soul on fire and spread its flames across our betrayed nation. Some 65 years ago, a nameless hero one among millions of warriors, declared, quote, "In times of gravest danger, the soul of our people erupts with elemental force to fend off all mortal blows and to assert itself. The soul's energy proves itself stronger than any numerical or material superiority. General readiness escalates to the highest action. What does his life mean to the individual if the sacred life of his race is threatened? He sacrifices himself so that that greater life is won. Superhuman feats are performed, and the word impossible is no longer known." Unquote. White America isn't dead yet. On the contrary, the sleeping giant is stirring from his propaganda-induced trance. And when he fully awakens, the puny enemies and congenital liars that scheme to kill him in his sleep will scatter like diseased vermin at the sight of his all-consuming rage. On your feet, white man! Stand up and fight!
Well, boys and girls, is there any part of that speech that you don't understand? I hope I don't have to explain it to you. While we were playing that, I was digging out some more of my articles that were stacked on a shelf, clippings and so forth, and getting them into a file cabinet. And I ran across one here of when I was jailed up in L.A. on the dumbest charge ever, burning refuse material without a permit, that referred to the cross, the Klan cross, of which I was not a part of that. I just was present at a gathering of several groups, unfortunately. Says here, this is a San Diego Union article. They were always my buddies. Shackled to a table in a drab blue jail interview room, Fallbrook white supremacist Tom Metzger leveled a bitter gaze and promised to remember those who put him behind bars for the first time in more than two decades of racist activity. Quote, "I won't ever forgive them for this," unquote, said Metzger as he sat immobilized by handcuffs. Quote, "Sentencing me to the maximum was totally vindictive. I have a family to support and my wife is seriously ill. I will not forget. I've got a long, long memory," unquote. Without his famous hairpiece, of which I regretted all my life, but sporting the beginnings of a full gray beard, Metzger is beginning his fourth week in county jail. He was sentenced to 6 months in jail for violating city codes during a cross-lighting 8 years ago, which they had been fighting for 8 years. Cost the city of L.A. a couple of million bucks through 8 years of legal hassle. It was his second major legal loss in little more than a year. In October 1990, a jury in Portland found him financially liable in the death of a Negro student who was beaten by Metzger's skinhead followers. Everybody was my follower. In the past year, Metzger lost his home, the tools from his television servicing business, and the assets from his racist enterprises in an effort to satisfy the record $12.5 million judgment leveled by the Portland jury. The bulk of the penalty was against him. He and his family moved to an apartment in Fallbrook and for a time received welfare. "Yeah, you're going to put me in jail, you're going to pay for it, buddy. Taxpayers, you're going to pay for it." Late last year, his wife of 28 years, Kathleen, was diagnosed with lung cancer. She has undergone extensive radiation and is 100% better, Metzger said during the jail interview. Unfortunately, that didn't last because she did die. A gregarious man prone to expounding his radical political views, Metzger said he has been depressed since his incarceration, but only when he runs out of things to read or do. "The first couple of days there were no one in the cell with me, no TV and no mail. That got a little rough," except for trips to the shower and weekly exercise outings on the jail's roof. Metzger, for his own safety, is housed in a jail hospital apart from other prisoners who may not share his philosophies. His days are spent in a 7-by-10-foot cell once inhabited by Charlie Manson. Quote, Charlie Manson was there for seven months. There are still inscriptions on the wall, a swastika and Helter Skelter 72. I don't know about Skelter, but Helter is there. Metzger said Helter Skelter was scrawled on the walls of Manson's victims' homes in the summer of 1969. When he leaves the cell, two sheriff's deputies accompany him. Quote, I've got the best security in Los Angeles, unquote, Metzger joked during the jailhouse interview last week. He also said that he's eating too much and has played rooftop basketball with former television star Adam Rich, recently sentenced for drug use. I get breakfast in bed, morning, noon, and evening, and I get to mingle with a lot of the best people, unquote, Metzger said. I write when the spirit moves me, and I read when something is available, unquote. After a few days of solitary confinement, he got his cellmate, co-defendant Brad Kelly. The two men talked about families and politics. It's humorous that we're both in here. Brad never belonged to any group, though he believes that white people should stand up for white people. Kelly was arrested with Metzger, apparently after accepting a neighbor's invitation to what was billed as a barbecue, during which three giant crosses were set ablaze in violation of city codes. They weren't giant. There was only one cross, and it was only about 12 feet high, and it was raining. The case dragged on for 8 years as Metzger and Reverend Butler of Aryan Nations fought the case. Is adamant that he went to jail for his beliefs, not for the crime. The former state grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, who later founded his own white Aryan resistance, Metzger considers himself a political prisoner. Superior Court Judge J.D. Smith is equally adamant that Metzger was not convicted for his thoughts, but because a jury found him guilty of breaking the law. Metzger said his family is pulling together real well. We've always educated them that these things may happen and not to be embarrassed. During phone calls home every other night, Metzger encourages his young daughters, Rebecca and Lori, to write to other political prisoners and tell them it's actually... Whoops. Hold it. Let me see here. There are murals on the walls, and there that once a week basketball on the roof. I'm terrible at basketball, and a little candy cart comes around twice a week. I do miss a cold beer, but that's a sort of like me, like sex. If it's not around, you don't miss it that much. But there's sometimes when his bravado gets overshadowed. I get close to crying when I talk to my wife or get a letter from her, he said. We've never been apart in 28 years. My wife says she's never had to write me a love letter before because we're always together, unquote. His daughters also did some artwork for him, but he can't display it on the jailhouse walls. Quote, Brad put up pictures of a couple of girls from Easy Rider magazine, and the deputies came and took them down. They don't give us a list of regulations here. They just come and say, you can't do that. In all, though, Metzger said he has no complaint about his jailers, adding that they treat him fairly, some even with certain awe and respect. every other day, a couple of deputies, most of them white, will come and stare through the cell windows and say, "Hey, is that him? It doesn't bother me." And during those rooftop interludes, when he can talk with fellow prisoners, Metzger said the conversations are pretty humorous. Metzger quotes, "I was arrested for unlawfully burning waste material. Inmate, oh, I'm here for murder." I was in there with the Menendez brothers who had murdered her mother and father. I talked to them about every day. And they talk pretty normal to me. This system is just a sham, and these poor people are only here because they failed. I tell them, next time, be smarter, and you may become the mayor. Above all, said Metzger, a sense of humor is helping him not become wrapped too tight and keep perspective on the separation from his family and the loss of personal freedom. Jailers confiscated his hairpiece when they issued him the blue jumpsuit stenciled with L.A. County Jail. Rubbing his bald head, Metzger said, "You can tell I'm really worrying since I've been here. I've lost all my hair, but everyone's finally figured me out, and I'm really a skinhead." The reason he spent the first days without a television is that it was broken, so Metzger, the appliance repairman, fixed it. "I just can't get away from it. I told deputies I'd fix them all if they gave me the tools, but they said they couldn't because of security." "Jail reminds me of the army," Metzger said. "Life is regulated. They turn the lights on and off for you. It's also just another piece of education for the 54-year-old Metzger who says he feels more complete than ever. I've experienced almost everything. I ran for office. I ran for small business. I ran a small business. I fought the IRS. I've been put in jail, and always there was the race thing." Metzger said he draws great satisfaction from having cost Los Angeles at least $1 million to try him over the 8 years, and his Confederates for having a little event out in the woods. His arrest that day in 1983 launched him into a study of legal twists and turns. He served as his own attorney in Portland, and with the firm belief, if you're going to go down, make it as expensive as possible for them. I feel quite successful at that. And I only lost that case by one juror. If I'd had one more juror vote for me, I'd have beat Morris Dees flat out. Police could have ticketed those burning crosses that day, Metzger said, and the fines would have been paid. That would have gotten the point across to the guys. But it was a grandstand play by the district attorney, Ira Reiner, the big shot Jew. And it cost the county plenty of money, but what do they care? They pay out millions all the time in L.A. County. Metzger actually could be out in 60 days, far short of his 6-month sentence. "And then all my friends in town will get together and we'll have a big laugh about this," he said. "We'll have a party and maybe shoot over to Vegas for a couple of days. I love to gamble, but I'm such a loser that I don't gamble hardly at all. If I lose $50, I think about it and worry about it for a month." "Then it's back to the business of the White Aryan Resistance," Metzger says. "The power of the movement is selling ideas. Quote, we have to concentrate on the media and the TV. This is a racist country, though many are racist for economic reasons, and that's wrong. I condemn Rodney King beating. Not that I think he's worth a damn, but nobody deserves to be treated like that," he said, referring to the black motorist whose videotape beating by the L.A. police last year raised a national furor. "No doubt what his future holds. He won't forgive the jail sentence. I'm like a grizzly in the North Woods. A hunter shoots it in the paw and is crippled, but that hunter better run because that bear is very dangerous and he's on his trail. And on that Rodney King thing, right after that happened, all the LA press was calling me. What's my position? And I know what they expect. You see, they never call you unless they expect you to say something that they want you to say. And I said, well, that was wrong, and it shouldn't have been done, and the police who did that, beat this man almost to death, should be prosecuted, because these same police would eventually and do it to white working people too. You think it's just black people the cops are beating on? They beat on white working men all the time. Well, that was the end of that story. I don't think it ever made it to the paper. Anyhow, that's a little of the history of crazy, terrible Tommy. And some of these pictures in the paper, like I say, I'm going to get them copied and make them available on our internet website. Well, that's it again for today. More BSing going on, man. We'll keep it. As long as you want to listen, I can keep the BS going. I'll be back. What is today? This is Friday. Freya's Day. Well, I'll be back Moon's Day, and we'll have some more stuff for you. Stuff. We got lots of stuff here.
Now, there's something else that is said after a death, but this one involves belief, which is where I begin to have big problems. This one happens after the funeral, after the burial, back at the house. Back at the house where the family and friends and the loved ones of the deceased are having some food and drink and enjoying some warm reminiscences of the person who passed away. Sooner or later, someone is bound to say the following, especially after a few drinks. You know, I think he's up there now, smiling down at us. And I think he's pleased. Now, first of all, there is no up there. For people to be smiling down from. It's poetic, it's quaint, and I guess for superstitious people it provides a little comfort, but it doesn't exist. But if it did, and if someone did somehow survive death in a non-physical form, I personally think he'd be far too busy with other celestial activities than to be standing around paradise, smiling down. On live people. What kind of a fucking eternity is that? And why is it no one ever says, I think he's down there now, smiling up at us? Apparently, it never occurs to people that their loved ones might be in hell.